Hello, everyone. Welcome into Debate Night. We are back yet again. We got Brody joining us from Waco, Silas behind the mixing board over there, and I'm in the old typical, well, not typical, temporary is the word I was looking for, studio space yet again, chilling on a couch in front of a backdrop. But Brody, how's Waco treating you so far? You've been down there for a little bit.
It's cold down there.
What's cold?
I don't know what's going on.
What are we talking about cold? Like, we're talking 50s?
40 and windy.
40 was the high today? And windy?
I think it got maybe up to like, I think it maybe got up to like 44.
Is that what the tournament weather is going to be like this weekend?
So the tournament looks like it's going to be, like Friday looks like it potentially has chances of being just an absolute awful day.
Oh,
high of 42. Oh. High of 42.
Oh, no.
Got that Lynchburg raining, weather, man.
You took it with you.
Consistent winds from 20 to 30 mile per hour with gusts that are higher.
Oh, my word.
So I think Friday we're looking at an absolute survival day.
Yeah.
It gets better after that. It'll be sunny and 55 on Saturday and sunny and 65 on Sunday with the winds. Sunday looks like it might be pretty windy too, 15 to 25. So Saturday looks like it's probably going to be the best day for scoring with the winds down 5 to 10.
That's
but yeah, I mean, Texas kind of coming out of the winter, you never know what to expect. It is something that I didn't really have on the docket of something that I wanted to talk about, but something as far as like looking into the schedule of like when tournaments are happening and stuff.
Yeah.
It might not be the worst thing to look into that. And again, I think a lot of it maybe has to come down to, you know, money and I actually don't know what else, but maybe there's not enough good courses in Florida to be able to start the tour in Florida.
I've heard a rumor that might be a plan in the future to kind of go Florida, then Midwest, then West Coast, then Northern Midwest, then Upper Northeast. Kind of make like a U shape. I don't know if that's true or not.
I don't really know what you were just talking about, but
like go across the bottom of the United States and then go up the West Coast and then come across the top of the United States and then go down the East Coast.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay, yes, yes, yes.
So like make it a big like U.
You like that direction? Yes.
That's a rumor I heard. I don't know when that would happen or if that's even a true plan, but that's, I think, how you get Florida involved in the tour early.
Yeah, because I think you just, you know, again, like we're not in a situation right now where we have massive amounts of spectators.
Yeah.
But even for the video guys, too, that are out there having to film and stuff, like if we can get it to where it's like decently comfortable temperatures and weather, I think that's ideal for all parties involved.
Well,
so, yeah. If we can push, you know, if there's a way of pushing the Texas swing back to like April,
man,
or even late April and have it flood over to into June or something.
Is it just too far north in
or
Texas?
May?
Like for the weather to be like this. Is it just
No, the weather in Texas is kind of crazy. Like it's going to be 62 tomorrow and it's going to be 73 on Thursday.
I'm just thinking like how could you possibly avoid, like if you start the tour early March without staying in like Florida or California for several weeks in a row, how do you avoid that?
No, you just have to do, if you just do 3 weeks, that's what I'm saying. If there's a way, I mean, Open at Tallahassee is a course that they're doing a Silver Series at. And then Throw Down the Mountain is another course that I've heard is good.
So you're
and
saying
then
do like course, 3 weeks in Florida to start it.
Yeah, the course in Jacksonville too is also that's where the last Silver Series event on the calendar of 2022 is, but that tournament will roll over into the 2023 season.
Yeah.
So if there's a way of like just don't even have that tournament in, when is it? November, I think, is when that tournament is.
November or December.
Don't even have that tournament in November. Like have the Open at Tallahassee, the Jacksonville tournament, and then find some other tournament or something to where we're doing three weeks, you know, three, even 4 weeks in Florida, because you could have a bye week in there too. And then, you know, you can start having, I'm sure like Arkansas is probably not that bad in April. You could probably do Jonesboro.
Jonesboro's had snow before. In the April? Tournament. Well, I don't know when the tournament is in Jonesboro. I feel like it's April range. It was definitely late March or it was definitely late March or early April. And there was one tournament where it was like 30 something and snowy for the Pro Tour there.
Yeah, I don't know if we want to go down there. I mean, again, like it's just it's something to think about because I know, you know, from a player standpoint, it is a little tricky. And from a spectator standpoint too, like I think everyone would enjoy being out in at least like 70 or plus. Maybe that's just the Florida boy in me talking, and people are like, "Nah, we want 40 degree cold temperature."
As a spectator, you're never like you know me. I enjoy cold weather. I'm not choosing to spectate a 40 degree tournament. I would never choose that.
It's tough.
I wouldn't mind playing in a 40 degree tournament. It's not going to deter me from that. But spectating, if like spectating revenue is something that the Pro Tour wants, which it clearly is. You're right in that. Like you got to be, I think like upper 50s, mid 60s and sunny, which obviously you can't control if it's sunny or not. That's a good, like that's a fine spectator day. But if you're in the 50s and it's rainy, it's already like rain in general is already deterring people. But then if you make it below 60 and rainy, that's a nightmare. Can't really get around that.
Yeah, no, I mean, we'll see what happens. But other than that, you know, the weather, other than the weather, I feel like I always talk about the weather. I don't know.
You should be the foundation weatherman. I think that's what I'm determined.
I'm not a good weather person, though.
No, like, that's what makes it funny. That's what makes it funny.
Yeah. Well, other than that, the course is looking good.
Nice.
No changes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No changes from last year as far as layout or pin placement or pars. Everything's playing exactly the same. One thing that is still to be determined is the OB line on hole one. Mm. If you remember last year, they pulled off the OB line from the wall. And so you had a lot of guys.
They took the wall out, didn't they? The final round, I think the wall was only halfway.
I'm not sure. I mean, it didn't really matter because if you got to the wall, you were already out of bounds.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. It's hard to tell if there's a white line underneath the wall or not, but hopefully that's something that is easier to figure out, you know, in tomorrow's practice round. Other than that, the only other real changes that I've seen so far is these new trash can.
I was going to ask you about that.
Upside down trash cans that I posted about on Twitter and social media and stuff.
What's the material? Like, is it literally like just a trash can material? Like it's just hard plastic?
I would say it's probably cheaper than a trash. It's not like, you know, Brute, like, you know, those like nice Rubbermaid trash cans. It's not like that. At first I thought Can Jam was sponsoring like the basket.
It's thin.
It's pretty flimsy.
So is it going to get dented and dinged up?
So I hit the first one today on an upshot. Cause we were really curious as to what was going to actually happen when you hit it.
Yeah.
And it pretty much just gives. So it just deadened it. Now, obviously if you hit it more like on a glancing blow, it probably will kind of trampoline it off.
Mm-hmm.
But if you hit it square, it's not like you're going to get some crazy bounce. Other things to think about is it does go further out than the cage. So something that I haven't looked into is, disc that hit the cage, the chances of what happens then, right? Because normally,
so it's wider than the bottom of the basket.
Well, the bottom of it is. So it's
oh, okay. It's like a cone shape.
Correct. The top is more. Yeah, top is a little smaller than the base. Some interesting, I would say, interesting reviews from people on social media. I thought I was going to see a lot more negativity. I think it's because maybe on camera, like in the photo, it's hard to see exactly what it looks like.
Yeah. I couldn't really tell what I was looking at.
Right up. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how that transpires to actual coverage. From the players I've talked to, I have yet to find someone that says it looks good. Everyone seems to think it's kind of an interesting look. Now, what I will say though is the advertising on it is much more easily readable than those little foam pads that they had previously.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, if they're like, hey, these foam pads, we were having a really hard time selling it, and we're able to sell this advertising space for way more, and it, more people are interested in it. I think then at that point, it's one of those things that where it's like, okay, can we maybe just adjust the material or something to make it look a little bit better? Some of the things that they're having difficulties on is some of these baskets aren't necessarily 100% vertical.
Yeah.
And especially the ground that they're on,
yeah,
isn't 100% flat. So you're starting to see where it's like, you now have another thing in there that's separate from the basket. So it's like, it's not level with the cage or the band, or it's not flush with the cage either. So viewing it, I'm very interested in to see, maybe it's a non-story. Maybe no one says anything during coverage and then it's a completely non-story. But at the same time, like, that's actually would be pretty bad, because then that would mean no one's looking actually at it for advertising.
Well, have you heard like any reasoning why they went away from like the foam koozie or whatever they were calling it?
I just think it's because it was hard to see on coverage.
I saw Pro Pool, for instance, not free advertising. Here we go. I saw theirs all the time. Like, it was pretty easy for me to see. I mean, obviously this is a much bigger thing, but to me, the foam one looked professional. It was coverage wise, like, I get where maybe it was just harder to see, but it looked professional. It was small enough that in weird situations, it wasn't touching the floor or the basket or the like cage really. So you didn't have to worry about anything like that. And it also didn't really seem to affect the play much. This one, the things I'm worried about is, A, I think the way they made it is probably because like baskets aren't universally the same. It's basically a lot depends on how the club put the basket in, how high it is or whatever. Yeah. So that might have something to do with it. But also the ground height to the bottom of the cage probably changes from like Mach X's to Prodigy T2s to whatever else you play on.
True.
So that might be part of why the design is the way it is. But it looked like, it almost looked like there was even a possibility of a disc like getting wedged in between.
Being stuck, yes.
Yeah, the bottom of the cage and the top of that. And also when I'm thinking, if it's bendable enough plastic that it bends and gives where a disc isn't going to roll away, then I'm thinking like a hard drive could dent it or at least scuff it up really bad. But then if it's not that,
look like?
Yeah, but then if that's not the case, I'd be worried about like if I throw a hyzer and it's coming in from 400 feet and I hit it, that's going to like now make it almost bounce off and roll away a lot more if it's not really malleable. So like, I mean, what is that going to look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. From a looks, like I said before, from a look standpoint, I haven't heard any pros talk about how they think it looks good. But I haven't heard any pros say that like, oh man, I got a terrible roll away or I threw a shot. Like I said, we've played two rounds out here now. I've hit it once. That's the only time I've seen it hit, and it didn't do anything. It didn't change anything. The two things I will say that I think look more professional, and something that I would rather, instead of putting something under the basket like that, I would rather sell the band at the top. So have advertisements and companies and stuff like that on the band, and then flags. Those would be the two things. Now, obviously, flags, when it's not windy, what's going to happen?
Could you do like a but cage at least wrap?
I've never seen that, but that's kind of cool.
I'm just thinking.
I will say this, as far as stuff that you're just like, oh my God, it looks weird. Like the cage wrap, for example, that wouldn't really affect play at all, right? It would look weird, but if you are an old MMA fan and used to watch the UFC back in the day, they the canvas that they fight on, and even like the actual octagon where they have like the padding and stuff in between the fences inside the octagon.
Yeah.
That always didn't used to look like what it looks like now.
Yeah.
So I can imagine people that watched the UFC, for example, way back in the day, and maybe the canvas was much cleaner. And now you look at it and there's like, just on the floor alone, there's probably like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like 10 plus advertisements.
Yeah.
Just on the floor. And I'm sure like if you have seen that from start to finish, you were probably like, what the heck? This looks terrible. But if you just jump into it now and it's the norm, it's probably not that big of a deal. So I think that's the same thing here, where like putting advertisements on the band, or like you said, a cage wrap, initially it probably will look weird. And I'm sure some people will be like, I don't like it.
Yeah.
But if it's a way of generating income for the tour, doesn't really change the play at all, it's something that I think we'll eventually all kind of get used to. So,
yeah, I mean, I enjoy the idea that they're exploring different ways to monetize the, like you were saying, find different revenue streams.
Yes,
that's great. I'm personally, like, if I would advertise, which, you know, we have advertised the Pro Tour, I would choose the koozie, the like square one, over the current one, just because like this one, it looks like you just took a Rubbermaid trash can and flipped it upside down. I'll have to see what it looks like on coverage, but just the picture that I saw, I'm looking at it and like not once did I think professional sport when I looked at it. The koozie, the like foam wrap, that looked professional to me. That looked like the NBA, like what you run into, the what is it, the stand for the basket, basically. That's what that reminded me of. So
they didn't have them all installed yet when we first were out there. And so on one of the holes, the first one we actually came across, it was in the woods, like 40 feet away from the basket.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, we all thought, we're like, are they putting advertisements on the trash cans? And then later in the round, we realized, oh no, that's not a trash can. That's like
going on the basket.
That's like on the basket now. So we'll see, but
they might also find a new way to like fasten it to the bottom of the cage or something, to where it closes the gap and makes it all coherent or something. I don't know. We'll have to see what it looks like on coverage. It might also just look incredible on camera and you only notice it in your person. And if that's the case, then I mean, run with it.
That's why I'm waiting to kind of see what the people, when everyone watches it on coverage, what everyone's thoughts are. Because if it's a unanimous like, hey, this looks terrible, then maybe they need to like reassess and do something differently. But if people are like, I didn't even really notice, then it's whatever. Other things with the tournament coming up, obviously we talked about the weather, we talked about the course. Let's talk about the field a little bit.
Yeah.
So you look at Las Vegas, and I think all of us, me, you, and Trevor included, we were all talking about, okay, this is a clear jump from what it was last year.
Yeah.
Of just the depth of the field. And I think now you look at Waco, and I think it's even better. I think the field's even better. I had I think it was Stat Mando or PDGA Stat. It might have been PDGA Stats on Twitter. He posted something in regards to like ratings and was like, this many thousand rated players and yada yada.
Yeah.
You know my thoughts on ratings. So I was just like, hey, can you pull the numbers on world rankings and give me that? Because that's something that would be kind of interesting. And I can't remember exactly what it was for FPO, but MPO was pretty easy because it was 70 of the top 100 players are in the field.
Nice.
So I think that's going off of UDisc world rankings, or it might have been the PGJ world rankings. But that just shows you like the field, that's a pretty deep field.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, that's what we were prepping for the Grip Lock preview show, and speaking to the deep field, we were like trying to do our predictions, and I was looking through and I was like, man, because Waco in general, looking back at the history of Waco, it's a tough one to predict, because on FPO it's been a little more straightforward, but on MPO, like, you had Colling won it twice in a row, Paul's won it, Colton Montgomery's won it, James Conrad's been in the mix. I think Nate Perkins was in the mix once. Like, it's been kind of all... Nico won it last year. It's been kind of all over the place. So I was looking at it, and I started going down the list, and just, like, person after person after person, I just kept on chair. I was like, they could win. They could win. They could win. They could... Like, there's legitimately 25 people that, before the start of the tournament, I looked at the list, and I was like, these 25 people could legitimately walk away winning Waco this year, and it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's a tournament... It's a tournament that definitely opens it to where, you know, Las Vegas, there are guys that were in that tournament that knew they had no chance of winning, yeah, right? Because they couldn't throw far enough.
Mm-hmm.
There's other tournaments where you might be a, let's say, forehand dominant player, and there are so many holes that require backhand. Specific backhands that you're going in and you're like, I'm at a huge disadvantage. I can't win this tournament, right?
Mm-hmm.
This course sets up for pretty much anyone. And that's like, if you, the list of people that you just listed off, you had Coling, who's a forehand dominant player.
Yeah. Yep.
You had James Conrad, who is a backhand dominant player.
Mm-hmm.
You had Nico, who throws flex shots.
Yep.
You have Paul, who throws straight shots.
Colton.
Who is another person?
Colton Montgomery.
Colton. He throws mostly hyzer shots.
Yeah.
So it's like there isn't a style of play that basically eliminates you. And the only thing, I mean, again, we don't have that many lefties on tour, so it's tough to be like, oh, well, this doesn't suit lefties. But the fact that forehand dominant and backhand dominant players can win this event, I think sets it up to where you can't count people out, where Vegas, I think you could go through the list and at a certain point you're like, all right, no one else can really win.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be very, very exciting. I think especially this is a tournament too, that the last couple holes set up so well for like decision making.
Mm-hmm.
Hole 15, 16, 17, and 18, you all have decisions off the tee. Even going back, I mean, hole 14, which is that little dinky par 3.
With the triple mando.
That's a straightforward shot. But going back a hole previous to that, hole 13, guys can two that hole.
Yeah.
So that's another one. You know, you're coming out of the woods and you have – what is it, 12, 13, 14, 15? No, wait, 13.
13 is the first open hole, yeah.
14, 15, 16, 17, 18. Yeah, so you have six holes coming out of the woods, and five of those six, you have a decision to make on the tee,
yeah,
of how aggressive you want to play. So I think that's where it makes it, from a viewer standpoint, very, very exciting, because I think, one, we're going to see, you know, a handful of people probably within a couple strokes coming down the stretch, and you can easily have two shot swings on a lot of those holes. So
yeah,
it's exciting one. And this is actually, I just thought about this today. Like it's been 2 years of me playing on tour. Like this is my 2 year reunion or anniversary, if you will. Which it seems like it's been so much longer than that. But yeah, 2 years ago, I played Waco for the first time.
Yeah.
And that was my first disc golf pro tour event. So
that's crazy.
This event, I think, does have a little bit more meaning to me than some of the other ones.
Yeah. I mean, that's what, because I was just looking back, because like shortly after you played Waco is when you bought into Foundation, I believe. Or is it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because that's the start of it.
Yeah.
And so looking back like a year, because we were looking at, I had to go back for tax returns because it's tax season, always fun. And I went back to 2019. I was like, man, 2019 was the start of Foundation. Like, that was only 3 years ago. And then it hit me that my two nieces were born before Foundation existed. And like, that just messed my timeline up, because like,
yeah,
Foundation, kind of like you were saying, like, it feels like it's been around for so long, kind of like you feel like you've been on tour for so long. But my nieces, like, I can see them. I know that they're only three. I can tell they haven't been around long. I can tell that they're, like, it seems like my nieces have been in my life, like, super recently. And Foundation, I've been doing for, like, 10 years. It was wild. But what's
I think it's the COVID and the quarantining. I think that really messed up a lot of
it threw off all the timelines. Yeah, it really just messed with it. So 2 years on the road. All right, I'm gonna put you on the spot. Most memorable moment of the first 2 years on tour.
Oh, that's easy. Okay. It was qualifying for USDGC at Goat Hill.
Nice.
Yeah.
I won't make you go through your least memorable moment. I won't make you relive. I don't know what it would be, but I'm not going to make you relive it. I'll play nice there. So the other thing, though.
I don't know. Go ahead.
I was going to talk about the field at Waco. If you want to go through your least memorable moment, you could think through it.
It would be hard for me to pick. There would be a lot of them.
Yeah. I was going to really quick, though, back to the field at Waco. Because,
let's do it.
We were talking about how deep the field is, but this is also we're seeing some players, like notable players, not playing. Now, for different reasons. You have Drew, who I believe is house shopping. Eagle, I think Waco requires a lot more forehands for him, and he's trying to rest the elbow. Last I had heard is the reason for not playing. Mm-hmm. But is this something that you think going forward now that the tour – now the tour, I guess, is a little bit more established and there's also a little bit more money involved in the sport. Is this something where you think is going to become a little bit more regular, where some of the top players are picking and choosing their tour stops that they know they can do well at and then picking and choosing their off weeks throughout the tour season?
Yeah. So do you know how the points work? As far as how many events count?
I'd have to relook at it. Isn't it like eight?
Yeah, so eight Elite Series and three Silver Series count.
Yeah.
So you're essentially being able to, you even if you played all of them, you have to throw out however many you played over eight, right?
Yeah.
And I think, especially, the two people you just listed, for example, they feel like, I don't know if they're going to play even all eight. I'm assuming they probably end up playing at least eight. But if they just play the bare minimum and maybe they have one or two bad tournaments, they're gonna still be able to get enough points to get in. I think what you're seeing right now is you're starting to see guys understand, and I talked to Ezra about this a little bit because, I'm kind of game planning with him a little bit on our schedule as far as, getting to and from some of these tournaments. And essentially what we've talked about is like, he noticed a drastic difference when he took a week off after playing 3 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
Right. And I think you're going to see more and more people realize that there really isn't as much benefit as there was back in the day. Because back in the day, it was I got to play every week because I got bills to pay. I have to earn some sort of money.
Yeah.
But now if you have a contract of where it's like guaranteed money and you know it's coming in, why would you play every event?
Yeah.
Like, why not be able to take a week off before? I mean, this is something that I'm even looking at right now. I mean, as much as I want to play Tallahassee, right?
Mm-hmm.
I want to play it. It's a Florida event. There's a good chance my mom's going to be able to come over and watch. I really want to play it. But you have Champions Cup the week after.
Yeah.
So I'm doing Waco, Belton, Texas States, and Music City Open. I'm doing all four of those. Do I really want Champions Cup to be my sixth tournament in a row?
Yeah, when you could just have that week, even go to Georgia a week early and just...
Yeah, or do I and get some practice in, be able to recover, take 1 or 2 days off after Music City Open. So I think guys are going to start being a little bit more strategic when it comes to their schedule as far as what tournaments they're going to want to play in and stuff, because I don't think it's as important. And also, too, with the rise of people on social media, I think there also was a little of this, like, I have to stay relevant, right? Mm-hmm. I have to go to every event so people don't forget about me, and I have to stay relevant. But now it's like a lot of people are starting to get big enough followings on social media to where they can keep their fans and stuff like that in the know of what they're up to. and they don't have to feel like they have to be grinding an entire season on tour. So I think you're going to start seeing that more from people of picking and choosing like elite series events. I'm not even talking because silver series, you already are seeing people that are just like, I'm not playing any silver series or I'm going to play these two. But I think you're going to start seeing some people too, like even their game, right? Like what if you're someone that necessarily doesn't have the distance?
Yeah.
Like what's the point of going to Vegas and, you know, competing for a top 20 in Vegas if you know that you can't, you know, throw far enough to really compete there? Like why even do that? So I think you're going to start seeing people be more strategic. And then I guess that moves on to something I did want to bring up, which was A tiers. I don't even want to bring up B tiers, but let's just talk about A tiers, right?
Yeah.
And obviously you guys, Griplock just came out yesterday and you guys talked about the memorial, right?
Yeah.
At what point do you guys no longer, because you talked about the memorial, but you didn't talk about, for example, you didn't talk about, I can't remember what event it was. I saw some tweet talking about it though. Joel Freeman ended up shredding some A tier that he played at.
Mm-hmm.
So like what made you decide that the memorial was newsworthy to talk about? And at what point, well, I guess, yeah, just answer that. Like what made you decide that you needed to talk about the results of memorial?
Well, several reasons. First being it was Paul's first tournament of the year. So mm-hmm. it was the first time we saw him, but also the memorial still has history. It's a dying, yeah. It's a dying history because it's not going to make it back on the pro tour. So I think realistically we're 2, 3, 4 years out from not talking about the memorial at all, because like right now it's still too, especially to like Trevor and I, that was the start of the season. And for so many disc golf fans, yep. that was the start yep. of the season, the start of the national tour, everything. And I think that's what you're seeing players still choosing that tournament, is it just feels right. Like it feels like mm-hmm. it doesn't feel like the disc golf season started. Like when Las Vegas Challenge, which used to be the Gentleman's Club Challenge, was like the week before.
I would disagree with you. There's one reason why the majority of people are playing at Memorial.
Why?
It's obvious.
The ratings?
It's not obvious. You don't know?
You saying yeah. ratings?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
No, 100%.
No. Because realistically nowadays, I mean, before this rating update.
Ratings still matter, though.
We're
going to get into
to who?
To manufacturers.
You think?
Yes.
Not yes. much longer.
I hope not, but they still do. And there, you know how it is. It takes a while. Takes a while for things to change.
Yeah.
And so it's going to take a while for people to still think that number next to my name literally means nothing.
Well, here's a question. But next year, Paul decides to not play Memorial. He's going to play Vegas, and then he's going to go down yeah. and start playing Waco.
Yeah.
And so now, because you already had this year, Ricky didn't show up, Eagle didn't show up. So you already had like yeah. some of the top rated players. We're going to talk ratings in the world.
Was Dickerson there?
I don't think so. No.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't believe so. So you already had some of the top rated players in the world. So and Paul shot one off of what is currently the highest rated round ever, 39. He shot a 40 opening round, and it was like 11.08. 24 mm-hmm. points off. One stroke different, 24 points off what it would be. Probably because the field had a lot to do with that. So now Paul disappears from that field. Ratings at that tournament aren't going to be special anymore. If you have one or two more top players disappear from that field, the ratings aren't going to be special anymore. Because, and my point is, or at least I think, I'd have to look back, but the Shelly Sharp Memorial is playing pretty much the same courses a few months before, and the
Shelly Sharp doesn't play.
It doesn't play
Shelly Sharp. It's
there's something that plays.
No, Shelly Sharp. There. No. Oh, Shelly Sharp is the one that's like south of Phoenix.
There's something that plays. That plays Fountain earlier in the year or in the off season that like some pros, yeah. some players go to because that are in Arizona.
Okay.
But that's not a tournament that everyone's showing up to. And since everyone's
maybe I'm thinking of Maricopa. Maybe I'm thinking Maricopa.
Yeah, but regardless, I think that like one or two players don't show up to it and the ratings aren't anything special anymore because the ratings are based on the field playing the course, not the course.
Well, here's another question.
It's a whole issue.
Going back to my like journalistic of like what's news and what's not. If Chris Dickerson decided to skip Vegas next year and play in some A tier in Tennessee the week before Waco, right? So not Memorial, some big A tier tournament in Tennessee. Are you covering that next year?
Depending on the field. Because the other big storyline here was Drew Gibson, who just won Vegas, was in the field and got beat by Paul.
Okay, so it's essentially to the point of where if enough good players show up at any tournament,
not any,
and that makes sense.
Because if this was the middle of the season, we had already seen Paul against the field, and we'd already seen like then so we weren't covering it.
You think it's more just the fact that
personally
it's
like we weren't early. Yeah, it was literally just it's a two-headed beast. It's one that it's the Memorial, so it still feels like the start of the disc golf season. We're not far enough removed.
100%.
The name, the Memorial, still has prestige in disc golf. And then two, 100%. It was Paul's first tournament against a strong field. If Paul's first tournament would have been at a local B tier or C tier, we might have covered it in like in brief passing. Like, hey, Paul came out, he played it. You know,
Weird, crazy happens or something.
Yeah, or like last week, if the Memorial didn't happen, we wouldn't have really any storylines. And so, if that would have been Paul's opening tournament, or Eagle would have had his opening tournament, or Paul, Ricky, Eagle, Calvin. Outside of those four, we probably wouldn't have said anything. But if those four would have played their opening tournament, we probably would have just like mentioned it in passing. But this one, it was just a storm of like, there was a very solid field of players that we just saw at Vegas. So we had a little bit of reference, one of them being the Vegas champion. And then Paul was now entered into that field, which was the storyline of like, this is Paul's first test against this somewhat full field, nowhere near fully full field. And then it also is the only time we're going to see Paul versus Drew until Champions Cup, which was another storyline.
True. Oh, I see. That makes you can have different storylines there. Yeah, for sure.
But speaking of like prestige,
Go for it.
This was another question I had with the tour because, like, again, like what you're asking me is a great question, and a big part of it is the prestige the Memorial still holds to me because it was the start of the disc golf season for so long. So the name the Memorial still holds prestige. Do you think with players picking and choosing their schedules and as that continues to develop, are there going to be tour events? Because this has happened in golf on the PGA Tour where there's tour events players just don't show up. Are there going to be tour events that have more prestige and so those fields are like notorious for being stronger than other events just because I don't know what will end up kind of separating it out, but is that going to be something that kind of happens where it's known like this event, the whole field's here versus the next week at Waco only half is? Or half of the best players?
So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. 12. Sorry, there's 12. So there's 12 excluding the playoffs, right? Because that's a different – we can't add in GMC and MVP because that's part of the playoffs. That's a different thing. There's 12 events.
Yeah.
I think from a player standpoint – there are multiple things that go into place for what is like would make it more meaningful than others. The first one I think is the easiest one, which is money.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The ones that have the highest purses, that's going to be, especially right now, how you can have, you know, Vegas, for example, with 6,000, it's not crazy to think that one of these events could come up with a purse of $12,000 for the first place. Mm-hmm. And so that's doubled, right? Yeah. So that's a massive, you know, if it's a small difference, it doesn't matter, but that's a massive difference. So I think that's one. The other one I think is the course. So something like Ledgestone, for example, where there is that prestige in Northwoods and how it is, you know, considered one of the more difficult courses. And then you have to play Eureka, which is another difficult course, but it's a completely different style. That tournament is going to hold a lot of prestige because people know that you can't really get fluky and you have to have four good rounds on two different style of courses that are both good courses.
Yeah.
That holds prestige. Is the course. And then the third thing I want to say, which is way down there. Like, I think those two are much higher than this third one that's on a different level. But I think this third one has potential of growing and getting higher up there, and that is the crowd, the fans.
The first two will probably draw the third.
Correct. Like, Des Moines, I've talked about this tournament multiple times. Des Moines, I don't think they had more people. I don't think they had like an absorbent amount of more fans than other events we played at. But they were loud, rowdy, enthusiastic. And so you can create some of these events where we know going into it, right? Like, this place, if you win this tournament, it is crazy because there are so many people. And again, this is something too that can have drastic changes because, you know, when you're dealing with 50,000 people versus 60,000, that 10,000 person gap's not that massive.
No, yeah.
But with the numbers we're dealing with, of where it's like, okay, Vegas had 1,000 fans, Des Moines has 7,000. Yeah. That is going to be a crazy noticeable change to where I think that is the third thing that probably adds prestige. I think you're going to see some of these tournaments. I think also a lot of it can be done on the tournament side of how they market it and how much money they put into it. So it's going to be really interesting to kind of see, because right now I think there's a couple tournaments that kind of jump out at you as like, you know, hey, if you could win an event, what event would you want to win at? But there also are a bunch that are kind of still just doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see kind of as we go, exactly like you're talking about with Memorial, how that still holds this prestige for you. Eventually that will slowly fade away.
Yeah.
And what other tournaments fill its spot and continue to go higher and higher to where, you know, obviously the majors are on a completely different level, but you know, an example in golf right now is the Players Championships happening this week. And that's notorious for having the best field in golf outside of majors, the best field. So that's where it's like what you're talking about is does Portland Open, for whatever reason, does that have the best field every year? And so, you know, going into it, like
a win everyone there.
That is going to win.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll see. But it's exciting to look at and definitely exciting to talk about, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's what, like, what's wild in my head is just, like, the kind of the evolution of the sport as it grows. Because, like, Memorial was always the start of the disc golf season. There was, like, the wintertime open would happen, and a lot of, like, California, Arizona pros would play it. It was just an A-tier that happened, like, a week or two before Memorial. And so that coverage would come out, and like everyone been dying, because at this time no one was making disc golf YouTube videos really. There was like a few, like Disc Golf Weekly, who now works for Dynamic Discs. He was making like disc reviews and disc golf. I believe Disc Golf Nerd, I think, was someone. There's Danny, who now also works for Dynamic. There was like a few people who were making tutorial content and disc reviews, but there wasn't nearly the amount of disc golf content that you consume in an off season back 2015, 2016. And so Wintertime Open happened, and I mean, every Central Coast would do it, and everyone's dying just to watch people play. And it was always Paul's tournament. Paul came out and always won it for years, like 11 in a row or something. So it was your first time seeing Paul play during the year. Other players would come out that were pretty notable. It gave you just that first taste. Then the Memorial would happen, and that was the actual like start of the tour. And then I remember Gentlemen's Club Challenge, which is now the Las Vegas Challenge. The Gentlemen's Club Challenge, at one point, jumped the gun and was before the Memorial, and it was like the start of the National Tour, and the Memorial was the start of the Pro Tour or something along those lines. And it just felt weird. It was the same thing when the Tour Championship happened after USDGC. The first year that happened, it felt awful.
It was weird.
It didn't feel right, because USDGC was the end of the disc golf season, and then we just had, and even players were talking about it, how like USDGC was the end, and now we have to gear up for another event.
Now it feels normal.
Now it feels normal. And that's the thing, is like now Vegas feels normal to me, to be the start of the disc golf season. The Memorial still has some prestige, but like we didn't do a preview show before Memorial, so it obviously doesn't have the same prestige to us. And you know, it's something that like next year we might talk about it in passing, and 2 years from now we might not even remember it. We might not even know it's happening.
You know what's really interesting now that I'm looking at the schedule? Well, first off, this is a different color orange, and that is freaking me out. I don't like that. I'm changing that immediately. What do you think about this real quick? Before, because I do want to talk about ratings a little bit.
Okay.
Because I did post a little tweet out there, so I do want to get your thoughts on that.
Okay.
But I'm looking at the schedule right now, and I have it in an Excel spreadsheet, so it's kind of easy to see for me, like the distribution of everything. This kind of caught my eye, and I didn't really think about it until you just were talking about how the Tour Championship and USDGC. What do you think about having USDGC pushed up? Now, obviously, that might be a situation with timing. As far as like, so don't even think about the course.
Okay.
Don't even think about like, oh, well, you can't push it up because school's still in session and yada. Don't even think about that. Just think about the actual placements of things. Right now, as is, USDGC is the week before the Tour Championship.
Mm-hmm.
And you literally go GMC, which is a playoff.
Yep.
MVP playoff, off week, USDGC Tour Championship. To me right now, the way that that's set up, it's kind of weird that you have this other event that's super, super meaningful thrown into this playoff structure. So I'm looking at it. Right now, we also go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You go 7 weeks until a major, okay?
Yeah.
Then you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 weeks a major. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks a major. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5 weeks a major.
Mm.
So they're like that first section.
And then Tour Championship almost feels like a major.
Yes. So what are your thoughts on like if the Champions Cup got moved up a little bit? If European Open got moved up a little bit, or Worlds, I think we have a disagreeing. I think, well, maybe we don't have a disagreeing opinion, but that's a tournament that is just kind of a weird one for me. Because really, that's what's crazy right now is you literally go World Championship, Silver Series that most people aren't going to play in, and then playoff off week USDGC Tour Championship. Like to me, I just think for the season, if you could space out the majors a little bit more and push everything in front of the playoffs, that would be for the Disc Golf Pro Tour's sake, that would be able, I think that would make it to where there would be a lot more focus on those, right? Because like you guys are going to be watching GMC MVP and you guys are probably going to be thinking, who looks like they're in a good spot to win USDGC?
Yeah, it's definitely gonna be a weird mindset.
You know, like that's probably what you're gonna be thinking. Like, who looks good right
like,
now?
Down
who's
the,
playing well right yeah. now? You're not thinking down like, that who's stretch, playing well to win the Tour Championship.
Yeah, because USDGC is like the most, in my opinion, if you take title out of it, it's the like the name of the tournament. It's the most prestigious tournament to win. It's the hardest tournament to win. Mainly because of the course and it being at the same course every year. That's kind of how it's got its prestige.
And the qualifying,
yeah, both of those combined. Because there's probably years where Worlds is technically harder to win. It's just like that happens one, and then the next year it's at a course that's way easier than USDGC. So it just kind of flip flops. But USDGC is always going to have its teeth out.
Well, the world's field is way worse than USDGC's field.
Well, I mean, what players are playing USDGC that aren't playing Worlds?
No, I'm saying that there are more people that get into the Worlds field that what's the number?
But that doesn't affect it. That doesn't really affect the quality of the field.
It does if the numbers matter.
Worlds normally has two pools. They normally have A pool and B pool, and they flip them. But like, when you're thinking of like quality of field, I'm thinking like, is the top 50 players there? And they're both at both. They're at both. So like the quality of
the
field.
I see what you're saying.
Like, I don't think that like, just the average rating the top, or whatever you want to use.
Are the top 80 at both?
Probably. I mean, 80 starts getting interesting because of the world ranking system. because it's still like it's fast. Have you looked at the world ranking after Vegas?
No.
Fascinating.
Which one?
The UDisc. I use the UDisc as the official because the PDGA didn't really update.
Let's talk about this. Yeah. Let's talk about this. Unless you had something else. Were we talking about something else? We were just talking about the
position of USDGC, but I don't know where I stand on it. We probably would have disagreed because I like it. I don't know. I don't know where I stand yet. Maybe we come back to that. Maybe we give me time to think through my decision on it.
But like my last thought on that, and then we'll go talk about ratings and world rankings and stuff, is think about this last USDGC, right? Like Paul wins.
Yeah.
Right. And then literally the next week, Nathan Queen wins.
No.
The biggest check of all time.
Back to back isn't like, good. That's not good.
The Paul story's gone.
Yeah. Well, it's either the Paul story's gone or like they're both overshadowed by each other. Because when you're looking back at the year, you're going to remember Paul's win more than Nathan Queen's win. Whereas, like, and you're also going to remember James Conrad's.
If they're spread out,
is it easy to remember both in your head? But they happen so quick back to back. Because, like, Conrad, you're not going to forget Conrad's win. You're not going to forget Paul's win. Your Nathan Queen's win, you might kind of slip over, but it's because it happened right after USDGC. But I don't know the answer to that one because, like, USDGC not being in October, like, to me would be like the Masters not being in April. Like, it just doesn't feel right.
To me, it's not even so much the fact that it's just like back to back. It's the fact that it's like in the middle of the playoff. That's what's like I didn't even think about this until now. Yeah. Just it's throwing it off because it's like GMC. I think you have like the top 100 guys get into GMC and then the top 70 or 60 then qualify for MVP. And then the top 36 or whatever qualify for the tour championship. But timeout, we're all going to go and play. Like, to me, that's where it's like, if you don't, let's say like I get 37th after MVP.
Yeah.
You don't see me play until next season. I'm done.
Yeah.
Versus like, this is like, I get 37th and then I go to USDGC and I win.
Well, no, if you get 37th at GMC, you might still have enough points to qualify.
No. I'm saying at the end of MVP, because you go GMC, MVP, then the tour championship.
Yeah.
I'm saying at the end of MVP,
whatever
I finish, I'm 37th in points.
Yeah.
And then I go 2 weeks later and win USDGC, and then the next week I'm not even in the tour championship.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's the split of...
That's like going to be awesome. Can I say that right
now?
They don't change anything?
That would be fascinating.
That would be awesome if someone wins USDGC and the next week they're not even in the tour championship.
I wonder if they would like give them a bye. Like they would let them in.
No, you can't.
You shouldn't.
They're two separate.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, though. I think that's the issue they're going to run into is the Pro Tour probably would love for USDGC not to be in the middle of that, but the Pro Tour has no control over USDGC. Heck, the PDGA doesn't even really have any control over the USDGC. Like they haven't even been they for years they've been running as an experimental major because they don't even abide by all the PDGA rules. Like that's how little control the PDGA has over the major. And so like could the PDGA even say, "Hey, Innova, we're moving USDGC to like let's just say they said we're moving it to where it's 7 weeks in between every major, so now it's in what would that be? Like late May or early June, USDGC?"
Well, I mean, you could put USDGC right before the playoffs where Worlds is. So you could do end of August.
So let's just say end of August. They're like, "Hey, we're moving it back to the end of August." Like, what happens if Innova goes no? Like, USDGC is literally trademarked by Disc Golf United, which is Innova East. I think it's technically trademarked by US Disc Golf or something.
It makes it tough.
Like, that's an interesting situation there.
They don't have, I don't think they have really a say.
Like, how does the PDGA, I'd be fascinated to know how much, like, where's the line of what the PDGA can and can't do with USDGC? Like, is there a point where they're like, the PDGA has to essentially recreate it and just call it US Open, the US Open or something, and fully move it away from Innova to get control over it? Or is it like, would the PDGA have to buy it from Innova? Or it's like, I don't know. USDGC is fascinating because it's my favorite tournament of the year by a mile. But I think it is such a realistically, I think it is such a like weird and I don't want to say bad because it's a great tournament for disc golf. But for the future of disc golf, there's going to be a problem with it. There's no way around it. There's gonna be.
It's one of those where it's like, do you want to just try to make changes right now before it gets too big?
But it's like, who's making the changes? Because like if Innova doesn't want to, well, Innova they're not gonna be able
Innova
to budge.
Definitely doesn't want to.
That's what I'm saying.
Innova definitely doesn't want to.
So like how is it gonna budge?
I think it boils down to like the PDGA. Again, we don't really know their involvement, but like I think it's gonna happen when like the PDGA is like, hey, we have this sponsor. You know, they get someone that's like, we want to sponsor USDGC. We want to be the title sponsor, yada, yada. And then potentially, like, at that point, you have the PDGA say, like, hey, Innova, you either do what we're asking or we're going to, like you said, we're going to start the US Open and we're going to have this title sponsor. Because, again, like, that's what I can't wait to see happen, because I think it is going to happen eventually. Something's going to happen right now where there is competition, because right now there really isn't any competition, right? And
the answer to this has to be yes, but like, is just the major title enough? Because like, if
that's what I want to know.
The USDGC has the only thing the PDGA could pull from USDGC is the tier. They could make it instead of a major.
Who made it a major?
The PDGA did.
Okay, so exactly. There you go. So the PDGA literally goes, guess what? USDGC, your event now is an A tier.
Yeah.
And we're going to run the US Open at Eagles Crossing, and the winner is going to get $100,000. And it's a major.
If the winner got $100,000, then yeah, no one's thinking twice. But I'm just thinking like the Throw Pink Women's Disc Golf Championship last year felt. To me, and I think to most people watching, it felt like a bigger tournament than U.S. Women's. Even like,
yes.
like people just talked about Missy Gannon winning all this. I couldn't tell you who won U.S. Women's right now, and U.S. Women's was the major. Like that just doesn't. Throw Pink Women's was an A tier.
But does that?
It's got a lot to do with the course and when it happened.
More with when it happened, because I think if the MPO wasn't there. And they did Throw Pink. The week before, and MPO is playing some other event that they're filming and stuff. Like I think that matters. I think
it definitely does. Yeah. But I'm just wondering, like, if because when Champions Cup was going to happen, and it was going to happen in the format it was, but it was still a major. The major alone wasn't enough for players to like. There's a lot of players that are willing to boycott it, even though it was still a major.
Who?
I mean, I know Paul said he wasn't going. I had heard other players say they weren't going.
Rubber meets the road.
A lot of the players that I heard that were going, they were excited because they were like, this is going to be the easiest major. This is the best major I have a chance at winning. So like, if you were outside the top 10, why weren't you showing up?
I think rubber meets the road. I think a lot of people would have showed up. Let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk what you're going to talk about with the world rankings. So what were you going to say first about the, was it the PDGA world rankings?
No, we were looking at the UDIS, because to this point, I'm still considering UDIS the official world rankings. The Pro Tour is still using them. They update the most regularly. What was confusing to me, and this is the thing that I think that the PDGA rankings are going to have over UDIS, is it still confuses me so much how they update. Trying to get to
how the world rankings update for MPO. Or sorry, for
we'll use MPO, but it's the same for UDISC. Yeah. Where on earth is this thing?
So I put up a poll recently. I don't know if you saw it on Twitter, and
how do you get to it in the app? Am I dumb right now?
You have to go to like UDISC Live.
Oh, you go UDISC Live and then rankings. Yep.
Then you see it. That's how I've always learned. All right. So I did a poll just to kind of gauge kind of what people on Twitter were thinking. And I said, what's your favorite, statistics or rating system? Mm-hmm. Right? Now, I think I left it open-ended like that. So I think some people definitely answered it for like themselves, like what they enjoy the most for like their themselves. And so I think that's why it might be skewed a little bit. I probably should have been a little more direct and said like, what's your favorite ranking system for like the Pro Tour? So I have PDGA rating, UDisc world ranking, PDGA world ranking, and the Disc Golf Pro Tour standings. PDGA world ranking was the lowest at 13%. UDisc world ranking was the highest at 39%. And then PDGA ranking came in at 30%. And the Disc Golf Pro Tour standings came in at 18%. So,
wait, which was the PDGA rating and which was the ranking percentage-wise?
The rating was 30, which was just behind...
Just below the world ranking.
UDisc.
Yeah.
And then the world ranking for the PDGA was the lowest.
Yeah, I think 13. I think the PDGA world ranking has the most... potential. I think they still need to tweak a little bit, but the reason I say that is because it's a lot more tangible on how you move up and down. Because the UDisc ranking seems to be relatively accurate for the most part, but this dominance index, like there's no way to know when a player is playing an event how much their dominance index is just going to fluctuate. And so that's what like we were looking at today, and you have a player like Gannon Burr. He jumped up 8 spots with almost winning into 15th place. Right
for UDisc.
Yeah, I'm talking UDisc right now. Because the PDGA, we don't know when it's gonna. It says it's gonna update after majors, I think. So UDisc updates after every tournament, which is what they've got going for them. So then Drew jumps up 4 places after a win. Paul doesn't play Vegas. Jumps Rick to become the number one world ranked without playing, and Rick just drops down. So that's confusing. Number one, because like, I mean, I guess it's just because Rick lost. But like, how can someone jump to number one in the world without being there? And then as you scroll down, there's also like Scott Withers just pops in new at 28th, just popped in right there. Like it just says new. It doesn't say how much he moved up or down. Well, and then here's a fascinating one. What place did you come in at Vegas? Like 38th?
37th, I think.
37th. So you came in 37th and yet you went down a spot in the world rankings to 79th. With your dominance ranking went up, but you went down, I guess, because... it must not have went up enough to jump Paul Omen, and then Scott Withers got thrown in at 28th. But that's what I'm saying is, like, I can't tell how accurate this is because I can't tell how they're getting the dominance index. Like, they have this whole article, so you can technically tell, but it's like player one meet player two, so it equals D1 divided by D1 plus D2. Okay. But, like, that doesn't help me. Like, when I'm watching a tournament, I don't know how to plug everyone into that formula and figure out, oh, well... okay, well, since Brody beat this person but lost to this person, D1 plus over D1 plus D2 equals, like, I'm not doing algebra 2 to figure out who's moving where.
I think what StatMando does, where you can, like, compare players, I think that's really cool.
Yeah,
right?
So you can do that in UDisc, too.
Oh, yeah, you can you? Mm-hmm. I can select this person.
Yeah, based on their dominance index, you can get the percentage chance of them beating them.
Oh, but StatMando is way better because it literally tells you like how many times they've played against each other, who's won more, how many top tens I think is also on there. So this is what I'll say that's confusing with the UDisc world ranking system is like obviously what you kind of just described, some of the issues of like that's odd. Do you know how far back this goes too?
No, that's the other thing.
How much is weighted on the front end too?
Yeah, that's what you can't find that type of information because like you have to have played a certain amount, but it's somewhere I forget when it was, but at some point they're like, for instance, if Nate Doss was in there, he would be at this spot with a dominance rating of this. But like Nate Doss has been retired for years. So like how does he have that dominance rating? You know what I'm saying? Like that's the thing I don't like about the UDisc system is they've probably created something incredible, but it's not
but
tangible.
It's hard to understand.
Exactly. Whereas the PDGAs, it's not going to update frequently enough, and they have too much weight on the majors. They split them up. It is what it is. But so, theirs you can see. Like you have tangible things of like if I do X, Y, and Z, I'm gonna be at this place in the world. Like you can see what you need to do to move up or down. And as a fan who talks about disc golf, I can more easily see how Ricky's placement is going to affect his world ranking or so on or so forth versus UDisc. I mean, Paul didn't show up and he moves up a spot. Like, is it like really smart to just not play tournament? Like, Paul didn't play because of the three courses, but if I'm someone who sucks at, if I sucked at Vegas, is it smart for me not to show up because it's good for my world ranking? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
So this is what, again, I don't really know too much on the math side of things, but the way I would view it is if you played bad at a tournament, you shouldn't fall. You shouldn't get like negative points. It's like, oh, you played bad, you get negative points. So then people that don't show up to the tournament pass you, right? It should be like, if you play bad at a tournament and other people around you in the rankings play better than you, then they're probably going to jump you in the rankings. That makes sense.
Yeah. It's weird.
It's weird to think that, like, if you have a bad tournament, and someone that wasn't at the tournament passes you in the world rankings. That seems weird to me. And the other thing I would say too is like the StatMando thing, I think, is really cool, of where it's like, okay, it's literally pinning people up to each other. I don't know how important that really is in the world rankings. And again, I think it makes it way more confusing as far as like, okay, if I finish fifth, for example, but these people beat me, that's different than if I finish fifth and then this one person beat, like, it's hard because, again, like you said, it's not an easy equation where, to me, like, the Disc Golf Pro Tour standings, it might not be the best way of doing it, but at least it's very, very simple to see, like, okay, I currently have, I'm in first place with the standings and I have 50 points more than second place. So then you can start doing a lot of these scenarios, right? Where it's like, all right, if this person, if Ricky, let's say Ricky was in first place, you can do a scenario where it's like, all right, if Ricky gets top five, the only way he drops out of first place is if this person wins. Like, you can do all those because you know the points.
Yeah.
This thing is so dependent on like who beats who, but then that person beat this person, so then they're going to jump. Like, that's where it's how did Ricky... Ricky got what, seventh place in the last event?
Yeah. So his dominance went down. People were confused.
He lost 6.82 points.
Yeah. When I said how can Paul become number one, I understand physically how it happened. Like I know Ricky lost dominance index. My thing is you shouldn't be able to not play. It's more so just for first place, for number one world ranking. Because if we're talking about 30th place and like someone becomes the going from 31st to 30th, or like that is what it is. But my thing is like this shouldn't be something, because like now what if Paul, this isn't going to happen, but what if Paul just parked the bus and just like, hey, I'm not playing tournaments this year. His dominance rating will never move.
The only way Ricky could beat him is if Ricky just started winning everything.
Yeah. But that's what I'm saying. It's like that doesn't make sense, because then like
Ricky would have to win.
Yeah. But if someone just parks the bus at this and then like, and their number one world ranking and their dominance index isn't going to change, then like people are going to constantly like be jumping and changing, and Paul will be like world ranked number one. And then as soon as Ricky loses, as soon as Ricky wins, Paul's world ranked number two. And now he's back to world ranked number one. And it's like, this guy's not playing right now. Like that shouldn't directly correlate. Like, you shouldn't be able to gain and become the number one ranked player in the world without showing up and playing. And that's where I think the flaw is with UDisc, that the PDGA system at least wouldn't have, but the PDGA system flaws is numerous other ones, but number one right now is it's not frequently updated.
This isn't per round, is it? It's
per event.
This is like per event.
It's right? Where you finish. So essentially, super dumbed down, how I understand it.
You know what? Wait, basically, let me tell you something that's really interesting real quick. There are only... I think if I saw this right, there are only like one or two guys that dropped more spots than Ricky did.
But
I don't think
it's because
he had a bad turn.
No, but it's because Ricky, who beat him. Tristan Tanner, one of the biggest ones. Look at how far Tristan Tanner's dominance index went up. That's the thing. It's all about who beat you at the tournament that affects the UDisc ranking. That's all that matters.
Yeah, so that's where. So this is where it's crazy to me. Is like that's
like
that's
Ricky
where
finished
it's
top 10 at a Pro Tour, but he got absolutely destroyed in the world ranking because of who beat him.
So let me give you this scenario, okay?
Yeah.
Jared Stoll. Okay, Jared Stoll is the last guy on this world ranking list at 162.
Okay.
Okay. Jared Stoll is playing Waco.
Yeah.
Okay. He balls out of control and plays out of his mind and gets ninth place.
Yeah.
Five shots out of the lead.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Adam Hammes gets 10th place.
Yeah.
Six shots out of the lead. Adam Hammes then proceeds. And let's just say Drew, Kyle, Chris, Calvin, Eagle, Ricky, Paul, all people above Adam, all beat Jared, right? They all get in front of Jared, but they're only beating by a stroke or two or whatever. It's real close, right?
Yeah.
Adam Hammes is just going to plummet.
Yeah, he'd get wrecked. Now, I don't know how far he'd get wrecked, but he'd get destroyed. And he finished top 10 at a Pro Tour in your scenario you just painted, and he might drop 15, 20 spots. Like, who knows what would happen?
And that's the thing is like he only drew for let's say in this scenario, Drew only beat Adam by two shots.
Yeah,
that's
where the issue is with the current
Drew maintains world ranking at 7, and Adam Hammes just flies down the rankings.
Yeah, but that's that issue is like I think the UDisc ranking is the best thing we have currently because it's what's updated frequently. And it's a better system than the actual rating system because the rating system is you can go win a C tier and your rating get tanked even though you won the C tier. Like at least with the ELO rating, that's not going to change that because it's basically just if you show up and you beat everyone, your ELO rating, your dominance factor is only going to go up. It's not going to go down if you win. But your rating, you could win and have your rating go down. Like that could happen. And so that's where you can't use the rating to tell who's the best player in the world. The ELO ranking is the best thing we have currently, but it's not great.
My boy is still alive as the sixth best player in the world based off of PDGA rating. He's still in there at 1044.
Who's that?
This local guy in Dallas, Texas that played one flex start and shot 1044.
Exactly. Like that. I don't think if you take a step back and just look at the ratings, you can understand why it's like the reason I think that I personally am so against the rating isn't because it's not a good analytic stat. Like within the round, like but it even isn't, to be honest with you, because like you can just look, it only matters within that tournament. And it doesn't super well correlate from tournament to tournament because it's all based on the field that's there. And within the tournament, if you want to see if it's a good round, just look at what they shot compared to the rest of the field. Like
that tells you the same thing.
But it's at least like it's a fun number that you can like pull out and be like, oh, what's your rating? Whatever.
Great for amateurs.
It's a fun phenomenal number. The issue is for so long, it's been treated as so much more than just a fun number. And that's why I'm so against it is like, if we just use it as a fun number and like, hey, holy cow, did you see that round was like 1108 that Paul shot at Memorial? Like, that's just a fun stat. Issue is you can't share that stat without it immediately being taken as a much bigger analytic than it is. Because, like I said, the field effects.
Yeah, but stats you should be able to understand.
True.
Right?
That's also true. You can't understand. You can kind of understand the rankings, ratings, but not really.
And it's almost kind of like, this is a good analogy. Is like you're like Paul shot 1108, right? If I told you, so you're like, dude, did you see Paul? He balled out of control. He shot 1108. What if I told you like, who's Duke's best basketball player?
Well, right now we all suck. Ben Caro.
Okay, Ben Caro. If I was like, dude, did you see Ben's last game? He scored
his first name's
points.
Pablo. His last name's Ben Caro, but it's fine.
Oh, his first. Okay. If I was like, dude, did you see Pablo's last game? He balled out of control. He scored 70 points. And you're like, what? He's insane. But I didn't tell you that there were six overtimes.
Yeah.
Like, that's where you're missing.
The
statistic needs more context. So in the 1108, for example, if the context was Yeah, but there also were a bunch of like low-rated guys that just throw a bunch of discs in the water and they basically jack up the ratings at Memorial. If that context was then thrown in, then you could be like, oh, okay, I can understand. But like when there isn't like this, when the statistics on that course are different than this course and different than that and different, like that's where it gets difficult if you don't have context. So,
no, exactly. But that's why my thing, my whole issue with ratings is that for so long, and I think that it's kind of died off, a lot of it was thanks to the UDisc World Rankings, was it was what was used to determine like the number one player in the world. And like that's what was posted. It's like Ricky Jumps, the number one rated player in the world, or Paul Jumps, the number one rated player in the world. But like the context is like, oh, like this literally happened at one point. Oh, Paul dropped out a number one rated player in the world because he played a weekly league at Huntington Beach. Like, why on earth is that? That shouldn't affect anything. Because, like, he won that the week he showed up, but, like, the ratings there are awful because it's just a weekly league. If you haven't played in a weekly – play in a weekly league and try to tell me that the ratings are always the same. Like, you won't because they suck.
Here's an interesting question. Are we doing calls or anything today?
We've got some, like, some of those voice memos if we need them, but we don't have to use them.
Maybe we open up a little bit to some of the comment section on YouTube. Are we just on YouTube today?
We're just on YouTube today. Yep.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going down on the YouTube comments.
Okay, so maybe we have Silas throw in some stuff here in a second. But
I
want to get
say,
your...
wrong, Hunter, wrong. Come at me, bro. So, Silas, figure out what on earth he thinks I'm wrong about and let me come at him.
He was talking about your rating. Your ratings don't matter thing.
Here's a good stat that should silence everyone. I am currently 974 rated. I have been as high as 990 rated within the last 989 rated within the last year and a half. You all watch me on YouTube regularly. If you truly think and you can look at me in the face and tell me I'm a 990 rated player, then you know maybe we can have a conversation that ratings aren't weird. But I'm not. Ratings are weird. Like there's no way I'm that high rated. I shouldn't be if they were true. That's
okay. Here's an interesting question. Now take aside, because I think this will kind of eventually like happen organically, or I guess happen just like naturally, of where like we were just talking about how players will start, you know, not even playing every pro tour event because there'll be so many pro tour events that just with their schedule they'll start picking and choosing. So I think naturally that will happen to everyone on tour, right? Because the money will start getting higher to where you don't have guys that – because we're still going to have guys that are touring and playing every Elite Series event, every Silver Series event that are going and trying to find on those bye weeks the nearest A tier or B tier, right? There's still going to be plenty of those people. I think eventually that gets phased out.
Yeah.
Of where the money – they're making enough money – on the pro tour that they're putting all their time and emphasis on that and they're no longer playing. But just as a fun question, do you think it should be, I don't know if illegal is the right word, but do you think it should be not allowed that if you are playing on the disc golf pro tour that you can't play in like A tiers?
No.
And B tiers?
No. That is making sense to me. Why would it not be allowed?
Well, I guess the question is why. Okay, well, I guess I need to answer that for you to have. I can't throw it back at you. why would it not be allowed? So I would say the reason why you would not want professionals to play in events that aren't on your tour would be. And this is not like anything along the lines like competition wise, right? Of where it's like, you know, someone playing in the NFL can't go and play in the Canadian Football League, right? Because that's like a competition thing. It's like, hey, we're signing you to play in the NFL.
Yeah.
This is because I don't think that exists. I think this is more, and I could be wrong here, but I think this is more to grow the game. So I think having. Now, this is different, right? Paige Pierce going to an A-tier event is going to have probably a better impact on more people maybe signing up or going out to that event.
Yeah.
So I think that would have like a net positive impact. but let's just drop it down to like maybe the 15th best FPO player in the world.
Okay.
Right? Her going to an A-tier event, she's probably going to win it, mm-hmm. right? And I don't think she's going to be bringing in, like, I don't think there's a net positive there, because I think what ends up happening is I think people, amateurs, and I would consider, again, if you're not doing the pro word is thrown around a lot in disc golf, but to me, everyone's an amateur unless they're playing disc golf for a living. Like, unless you're doing it as your job, you're an amateur, right? It's not your profession.
Yeah.
So even though you are playing an open and you are getting money, if you're not doing it as a profession, you're not in the same tier, right?
Yeah.
So
there's different levels to being a pro.
So the question is, like, are you signing up for that tournament if you see people that you're just like, well, this person's just way better than me? Like, is that killing the local scene?
No.
Or do you think having someone that bounces in and plays local events and wins everything, do you think that helps grow the local scene more than it hurts it?
I think it's probably at worst neutral. At worst. I think there's more positives than negatives. I think that, like, there's going to come a point where Pro Tour players can't play Silver Series, because I think that Silver Series are going to eventually develop into how you qualify to be on the Pro Tour. So that would make sense.
Well, if that's the case, then why would they not say then they can't? Because
that's directly taking away potential spots and points for someone trying to qualify for the tour card.
True. Fair point. But why is this – why – I guess the question is then, why is this a rule in other sports?
Well, name another. So you got to look at it in a little bit of a different perspective, right? A tiers, B tiers, C tiers, as the Pro Tour and Silver Series develop, are essentially going to be like more or less, if you're going to have to directly correlate it to other sports, like your random golf weekly or your random golf tournament that the fire department puts on at the course. Like if John Rahm was in town and wanted to roll up to that thing, why wouldn't he? He could, right? There's nothing stopping him from, like, the fire department fundraiser event that's going on at Poplar Forest. He would legally not be able to play golf that day.
I don't know. Let me text him. Let me text him and see.
Why wouldn't he? Unless it's a contract of, like, who's his club sponsor?
Hold on. Let me text him. And let me just make sure my text is correct, so when we get the answer back, it's right. So I'm saying, are you allowed to play random local golf events for money? ? Is that a fair question?
I mean, you might want to put context that, like, you're not asking them to play in one, because that might affect the answer.
Oh. Okay.
Because, like, if I'm getting that text, I might be like, heck no, I'm not allowed.
This is just a question I have on what the PGA Tour allows for their players.
Yeah.
Because we know, right? We know that in other... Because I think you have to relate it to the problem is I'm not well versed on basketball. That's what I'm saying. We have to use niche sports that are individual and are tournament based. I'm not well versed enough, like skateboarding, surfing. We have to use those of, like,
what
if you're
tennis?
On the professional. Tennis, yes, Silas.
Like, could Nadal not show up to the Boonesboro Country Club tennis tournament? Like, they're not. My thing is, like, it makes sense. Like, NFL, you can't go play in the XFL.
Rob literally just said no idea.
Yeah. Well, it's probably because, like, why on earth would you?
The problem is, that's what I'm saying. They're making so much money that why in the world would they ever put themselves in a position to play and potentially lose to some local pro at some event?
Absolutely.
Right? Like, that's.
Yeah,
they're putting themselves in a very, very bad position there.
But I would be shocked if there's a rule, because, like, how could you regulate that? How could you, like, it makes sense for the PGA Tour to
I'm
say.
I'm asking another guy.
Okay.
I'm asking someone that actually
Because like it makes sense for the PGA Tour to say you can't play like a different tour event, like a one of the mini tours or something like that. That makes sense. But I'm saying like the A, B, C tiers, you got to correlate to like YMCA ball or like
Silas,
the big
let me,
three.
Let me know what Silas. Let me know what the chat is saying because it's more.
Here you go.
Them.
Here you go. I got an answer. I got an answer. He's This is from Judah Aderhold.
Judah Aderhold.
He said he's definitely allowed, I believe. Joel Dahman has a tour card, is playing the Scottsdale Open, just a local pro event. Boom.
Mm. Okay.
Boom.
So I think that, like, I think what you're saying is true when it comes to, like, Silver Series, where you might be taking something directly away from
that
someone trying
sense.
To qualify. But
my whole thing was, I was just looking out for like players in the event, and maybe I'm completely wrong.
I think you're wrong.
Maybe
a great example
maybe
is
having a pro in the field gets you jacked up, and you're like, yeah. I thought maybe the other way of where you see someone comes into the field, and now you're like, well, now I'm playing for second place. I could be completely wrong.
I know
people in different divisions feel that way. Like when you have a sandbagger, for example.
Well, a sandbagger's a little bit different. Actually, a lot of it different because like you're talking a touring pro, so someone you don't really get to see. They're not at every weekend, week out event. And so, for instance, for our local area, this was Chris Dickerson and Zach Melton. And when they would sign up for like Mountain Mayhem, the pro field would grow by like three times. A lot of them were AMs moving up, but the reason was you wanted the chance to play with them round one. And then for me, I was lucky enough. I got absolutely destroyed, but I was fighting with the other local pro, his name's KP, for third place at that tournament. And so I was on a card where Zach and Chris are battling for one and two, and then, you know, probably 10 strokes back, you have me and KP battling for three and four. But it was a very fun experience for me because there were people who came to watch Zach and Chris. I also got to see Zach and Chris in tournament mode, and it was just a great learning experience for me playing alongside them. And so it was something, and another great example.
I'm citing to you now. Yeah. I'm saying my initial thought on this was wrong.
Yeah. Well, because also the battle for Bedford is a great example. Like the pro field's a lot easier to fill if you, Paul, and like one or two other bigger name pros are in there than if no big name pros are in there.
Yeah.
Because people want the chance to play with you guys. That's the thing.
I stand corrected. I'm wrong. But when it comes to
Silver Series, you're right. 100%.
Well, that was my initial
Silver Series.
Yeah, my initial point was wrong. So here's a question though. Do you think, and then Silas, you can start grabbing some questions from the chat. Do you think there should be a rule in place that says something along the lines of like, if you win in like MA4? You have to move up to MA3. If you win an MA3, and the only reason I'm saying this is what my buddy's, his philosophy is for his own personal self, is like he is never leaving MA4 until he wins. And as soon as he wins, then he's going to move up to MA3. He's staying in MA4. Do you think, though, there should be a rule of like maybe not MA2 to MA1, but at least MA4 and MA3, do you think there should be a rule of like, if you win, you have to move up, or what are your thoughts?
That's tough. So that's the exact thing I did, is I started at MA2, and once I won, I just moved up to MA1, and I parked myself in MA1, because once you're at MA1, like, people will call you a sandbagger here and there, but you literally you can't sandbag in MA1 like that. You're the top AM division.
It's
you can't
tough.
You can't sandbag. You can literally be a 1,000 rated player and be an MA1. It's fine, but
that rule I'm now seeing flaws in it, because what if you go and like he plays one tournament every year, right? It's the Halloween Classic. It's the big tournament in Vegas for like definitely for amateurs outside the Las Vegas Challenge. And everyone goes to this tournament.
Yeah.
So like if he beats everyone, he basically has beaten everyone in that field. The problem with the rule that I'm now thinking about is, say you're someone that plays 10 events a year and the field is drastically different from an event to event. So you might go play one event at MA4 and you only beat three people.
Yeah.
And those three people weren't really people that you were ever competing against in MA4. Mm-hmm. So then it's like you could go to the next week MA4 and there could be 10 people in the field and three of them you're competing with. Like, so like, I don't know. I don't think you can do that.
No, but there's got to be the way they're doing it now isn't awful. It's just that the rating system's flawed. And so it makes it tough. It also, like, they can adjust how high or low the ratings are. But the biggest point to, like, what you were just saying is you have really big amateur tournaments. Like, Bowling Green AMs used to be massive. You have USA DGC, Ledgestone's massive for AMs. Those divisions, like, MA2 at some of those are way harder to win than MA1 at your local course. And so if you're playing like just local C tiers, you might be able to roll up and destroy MA3, and now you moved up to MA2, and you destroy MA2, and now you're chilling in MA1. When you roll up to Ledgestone, you might belong in MA3. You could have been competitive in MA3, but if that rule's in place, now you're showing up to Ledgestone and you're playing with people who are 980 rated, trying to win Ledgestone because they have AM World's dreams or US AM's dreams, and you're sitting there like, well, this sucks because like. I literally, there's no way I can compete with these players, but because I won some back home, I can't play down.
Okay, here's two thoughts, okay? One, because I just had another one of my buddies that plays on the Pro Tour text me back. Shout out to Austin Cook. I've learned that people that are making millions of dollars, literally this does not, they have no idea.
Well, yeah, why would they show up to win this is, 50, 100, 200 bucks at a local
this
local
other guy literally thing? Said, This other guy literally said the same thing as Rom of like, I honestly have no idea.
it's just something that probably never, ever comes up. I'd be surprised if the PGA Tour has even thought of it because they're probably like, I mean, why would we care what these guys do?
I Google searched it and literally nothing came up.
It's probably like, never come up.
Why would you do that?
Like, why would Tiger Woods roll up to play Mama Joe's Sweet Chili Cookout Classic? Like, that's never happening.
Well, you know, that's how crazy we'll be if we're 50 years from now saying the same thing of like, why would that person ever show up and play an A tier? So that will be kind of cool to see the growth there.
Yeah.
The other thing I was going to say is I think this is how you combat sandbaggers. And let me know if you think I'm right or wrong on this.
Let's hear it.
Right now, you do have some sandbaggers that are those Halo players that get really high ranked in Halo or Call of Duty or whatever it is. You get really, really high ranked and your matches start getting really, really hard. So what do you do to like drop down your rank? You literally just find a corner and just chuck grenades and self-suicide yourself.
Yeah, or you just constantly spawn into a game and tape your spinning controller down while you do homework. So you're moving, but you're not doing nothing.
I think there are some players that do that a little bit to an extreme of where if they're having a bad round, let's have a really bad round.
Yeah, let's just make it a little worse.
So that way we drop because the rating does that's you once your rating gets above something, then you have to go
move up,
right?
Yes. Yes.
So the way that you eliminate that is what we're doing right now. Is we're the rating is too much of an average, right? It's too much of a in the middle of what you shoot versus what you shoot when you play well.
Yeah.
Because I think especially for amateurs divisions to be competitive, you don't want someone in MA3 that could win MA1 if they played well. Correct. But their rating puts them in MA3 because they can go out there and get last place in MA3 sometimes, right? Yep. They're so volatile that their average puts them in MA3, but when they're at their best, they can beat MA1 people.
Yeah.
So I think if you literally just do something where it's like, hey, you know what? For our ratings, we're only going to count your top 40% scores.
Yeah.
That's it. So if you have... if you have 10 rated rounds and 60%, you know, the top 40% are all 1,000 rated plus, but you have some 910s, some 920s, a couple 950s, that would actually probably put your rating at like 955, let's say.
Yeah.
Like you no longer are playing in a division where it's like you see sometimes where you're like, oh my God, this MA2 guy just freaking would have won MA1, right? Or sometimes the really drastic ones, you see sometimes people in amateurs like competing against open, like their scores, right? And like those are like the crazy events where you're like, what the heck is going on? So does that fix the problem of where it's like, you know what, we're just going to eliminate your low scores so that way you don't have these sandbaggers? Because that is an issue right now.
No, yeah.
I see it all the time on social media, people complaining about it. And I would too. Like if I was playing in MA3 and I know this guy is playing in MA3 and I'm like, okay, this guy's just going to win. Like he shouldn't be playing in MA3. That would get really, really annoying. So I think does that eliminate it?
I think it at least helps eliminate it, because you're right. I mean, there's a reason that AMs are AMs. I should be an AM. There's no way I'm literally paying $75 to have pro next to my name. That's the only reason I'm a pro. The AMs, like I could go out.
Proud of you, man.
And I could go out and at the best, I could shoot and compete with like 990 rated players. But as everyone's seen, at my worst, I can shoot 900 rated golf, and I have this wide range. So like
your range is very wide.
If I was playing tournaments every single weekend, I'd probably be like a 950 some rated player. So if I was like slightly worse version of myself, I could very easily be able to play rec. But then like you're saying, I could go out and pop off and shoot. And I've seen this happen in rec tournaments I've ran, shoot like 970, 980 rated golf, where you're like, holy cow, that guy in rec might have almost won advance this weekend. But it's because the last weekend he shot 810 rated golf. And that's just like, because there's always something. For me, it's my putting. If my putting's on, I'm playing great. That makes me throw better, makes me do everything. But if my putting's off, especially some people are like spin putters, to where like if their putting's off, they're throwing a 30-foot putt and they're having a 60-foot comebacker. Yes. And like if your putting's off, that person might shoot 800 rated. But if their putting's on, they might be a 1,000 rated player. And I think what you're saying, I think it can't hurt it. And honestly, it can't hurt the system in general, because like then it also takes the stress off of like if you go out and just absolutely tank around, because I've had this happen before where I have a little bit of an injury, but I'm in a tournament where I drove 2 hours to play this tournament. And so I have a little bit of an injury or something like that where I don't want to drop out of the tournament. But now in the back of my head, I'm like, it hurts when I putt. So I suck at putting right now. I have no confidence. So I end up shooting like 910, 850 rated golf, whatever it may be in the scenario. But like now I'm penalized for not giving up, for not quitting. Versus if I would have just went to the TD and been like, hey man, wrist really is hurting me, I'm not gonna be able to play the second round, then I'm rewarded for that versus playing it. Versus in your scenario, go have fun, play the tournament. It doesn't matter what you shot. If you do awful, it's not really gonna hurt you, because it's show your rating's gonna be what your potential play is, which is kind of how you should be based on like your potential play, because you don't want MA3 players shooting good to win open.
Yeah. To me, it makes a lot more sense for the rating to be more about, if I play good, this is what I should be shooting. So that way you have everyone that goes in, and it basically makes it the ceiling, right? Like it makes it to where like me, you, Trevor, and Silas, we all go out and play. The only way, if we're playing like New London, for example,
yeah,
the only way you're going into that course thinking that you can beat me is if you play really good and I play terrible.
Yes.
Right? Versus you put yourself in a position where you're like, all right, all of us have the potential of shooting the same score out here. It's whoever can get to the best potential.
Yeah.
Right? Versus like, so you don't have a scenario where someone's like, I played really, really out of my mind, and someone else is like, I played okay, and the person that played okay beat you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
that idea.
All right. Well, that's one thought. All right, Silas, you want to pull some questions maybe from chat? We'll do that for a little bit. And then I got to pick up my buddy from the bus station.
All right. Anybody got any questions? Drop them in the YouTube comments below.
Oh, do you have any voice calls, Hunter, queued up?
Yeah, I can queue one up. You want me to queue one up, Silas?
Yeah.
Queue one up while Silas.
Okay, I don't remember what this one was, but I start it. So we'll start it here. It's from Michael Miller. It's loading. Still loading. I would ask if our Wi-Fi went out, but then we wouldn't be able to stream right now. So,
Dark Horse.
Let me go to data and see if that helps me. I'm gonna refresh the page.
Well, while you're doing that, let me do. Let me shout out our sponsor, Atlas. Not really our sponsor, but yeah, I want to quickly talk about that. Maybe that's something that some people might have some more questions. I saw on social media people had questions. I'm very, very excited to be working with Atlas. The vision that they have currently is something that I extremely align with, and being able to bring very high quality products at an affordable price, I think is huge. And I'm very excited about the bag dropping, I believe Thursday.
Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern.
Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern, the bag's dropping. We didn't really explain it too well about like the badges and patches because I saw a lot of people talk.
I think we got a post coming a little bit. I don't know. Did his mic go out, Silas?
Did I just mute myself? Can you hear me now?
You're back.
Okay. The gold patches are only going to be available for the people that get the Dark Horse bag.
Yes.
And the gray patches will be, I think,
they'll be for sale.
Available for individual sale. And the other thing too, I wanted to explain quickly is this is the Dark Horse bag is like the name of the color of the bag. We are working on a signature Dark Horse bag that will be coming in the future.
Yeah, so, this is simply a colorway.
Yes.
Basically, this is the blacked out Pioneer, but the Dark Horse Pioneer, gets the gold exclusive patch, all of that good stuff. This is also the first drop of the V2 with the Pioneer, which means the phone pocket on the side. That was one of the complaints we had. We made it a little bit deeper and a little bit wider so it fits bigger phones, and also your phone's a lot more secure in there. Also, the same goes for like chalk pouches, minis, all of that, a lot more secure. And also the water bottle holder now fits, I believe it's up to 48 ounces, but very, very comfortably fits 32-ounce bottles now, so that's a little bit wider than I think our original bag fit up to 32, but 24 was the comfortable number. The elastic's on it bigger. So it's a few minor changes just from customer feedback that was made to the bag, but the Dark Horse is the colorway. So the Dark Horse bag isn't going to be different from the normal Pioneer. It's just the colorway is that blacked out version that Brody's been carrying.
It also will hold enough discs for everyone that's listening. I carry a decent amount of discs. I think I want to say I carry close to like 20, definitely over 25 discs in my bag right now. It might even be 27, which is way too many for most people. But when you're playing these long courses, there's, three or four discs that I have in my bag that are specific for certain situations.
Yeah.
Do you need to do that when you're playing casual rounds? Absolutely not. I normally take those discs out when I'm playing casual rounds. But for tournament play, it's pretty important for that. So the pro bag, I think, will also, like the bag that we're going to be designing, that will be the signature bag down the road, will also be able to hold a lot of discs. This holds plenty of discs. And then do we have any like reviews, like personal, like what are they called when
testimonials?
They're not called reviews. Testimonials.
We do have some. I don't have them on hand, but
I'll give you a personal testimonial though from my caddy in Vegas. After the first day that he carried the bag, he literally told me how surprised he was at how light of a bag it is. And I think that is probably the one thing that will be the quickest thing for you to realize with the bag is your back and legs will feel so much better the next day after carrying the bag than some of the other bags that are out there. So that comes out on Thursday. Super excited about it. We've got a lot of stuff going on in the future with Atlas, so stay tuned to that. All right, do we got questions here?
Yeah, I think there should be some rolling in. What you got, Silas?
Yeah. So first one comes from Chris Evans, and he says, how far are we from swing coaches and caddies, and will they be actually useful for the top pros? So, Brody, you can probably You probably have a good idea, and you can answer.
Oh, okay, Silas. Yeah, sure. I have no input.
I was literally about to say, Brody, that's true, my opinion.
I'm too low rated for my opinion to matter. I was literally about to say Brody would have a better answer on this one. I just thought it was funny that Silas called me out.
Hey, man, you're not on tour yet.
All right, Caddy.
You don't need to put a yet at the end of that.
Caddy's 100%. And I think you're going to see that the number of caddies on tour increase higher and higher. I do know this for a fact. On the PGA Tour, you are required to have a caddy.
Mm. That's interesting. I didn't know that. Why? What's the reason behind they require them?
That I don't know. I would just be talking out my butt if I gave you an answer. I can guess and just say the look of it, of just having someone else carry your bag.
Yeah.
Looks more professional than carrying your own bag, which is like what you would do at the amateur level or on some of these lower tours, you carry your own bag. But I've definitely have heard stories of guys being in situations where they didn't have a caddy and essentially the club that you're playing at. So it's very similar to what it is in disc golf, actually, of where, you know, if I wanted a caddy for Waco, I would like instead of going to the club that doesn't exist at Waco, I would go to like the Facebook group and be like, hey, does anyone want a caddy for me? Where the club that actually has caddies already for like their members that play there.
Yeah.
So you would just pick up them. A cool story is the PGA Championship. One of the guys that was like in the top, I want to say he was at in the top 10, maybe top five at some point. He was like an amateur playing in the event. He wasn't a touring pro. And so he picked up a local caddy. That local caddy was the same caddy that I got when we played the course, because we used to play the course. That was like a thing that we did on YouTube. We would go and play the very, very last day before the course closed down.
Yeah.
And that was to help like promote the tournament and stuff. So they gave me this caddy because he was like the go-to caddy. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a whole video with him. Fascinating guy. And all of a sudden, like, I'm watching the PGA Championship and I'm like, oh my God, I can't remember his name, but I'm like, oh my God, that's so and so. I'm like, that was my caddy. And now all of a sudden, he's caddying for this guy that's in the top 10 of the PGA Championship.
Yeah.
So, caddies 100%. There's literally, if there's a pro out there that says it's there's a negative to having a caddy, I would say that they're either lying to you or they have no idea what they're talking about. There's literally no negative to it. Literally. The only thing that could be negative is if you literally get a caddy of someone that you hate and that you don't like.
So why don't we walk through worlds when I got kicked off the bag? Why don't we just like relive that moment if there's no negatives to being a caddy?
You got kicked off the bag at Worlds?
I was on your bag 2 worlds ago. Or Ledgestone. Ledgestone. I get them confused.
I was going to say, I didn't play Worlds two years ago.
No, I get Ledgestone, I get confused with Worlds that year because they were in the same place.
No, I think I kicked you off the bag at Idlewild.
No, it was Northwoods Black.
Was it?
Yeah, it was the little like the forehand hole that goes over the valley and back up.
Here, this is what I'll say. I will say that if that was this year, I wouldn't have kicked you off the bag.
Hmm.
I think it was because our relationship wasn't where our relationship is now. We have a much better.
I don't even think I said anything. I literally think I was just, I was literally just carrying his bag. Just like, I was just walking down carrying his bag and we get to the hole and he just like, yeah, this is throwing me off. No, I think it was, I think it was more you weren't used to a caddy yet. If I had to guess.
No. I think that, no. If I went back in the day, I would 100% tell you that was an excuse. 100%. That was 100%.
Well, that excuse made me feel better. So now I got nothing.
Oh, I'm playing bad because you're caddying for me. No. That was 100% excuse. I knew that was
the excuse. I thought you were saying you were just making an excuse up to kick me off the bag. Like you just wanted me out of there.
No. I didn't want you out.
He hates your guts.
Yeah, I know. Honestly, geez.
No, it was one of those, I, again, you're talking about someone, that tournament was... That was the first year I was on tour, wasn't it?
Yes. This was your first time playing Northwoods Black.
Yeah, that was my third tournament or fourth tournament. I was like way, I mean, I was way out in front of my skis. I had no idea what I was doing. So in that scenario, when you're literally, you know, gasping for breath because you're like slowly sinking under the water, you're willing to at that point literally try to do anything to be like, let me walk under this ladder. Let me throw this rock into this mirror. Let me open this umbrella inside. You're literally trying to do anything. And again, I think that shows you the difference between someone that is a mature player on tour and someone that's an immature player on tour is, and again, I've gone through all this, so I've seen it. A mature player is going to be someone that doesn't make excuses and doesn't say like, oh, well, I'm not playing well today because this, this, and this, and this.
Yeah.
Right. They're not going to say like, again, what was another reason that I gave for why I played so bad? Because I lost that disc. You remember? That was another.
Cause that was the first thing I did. As soon as you kicked me off the bag, I went and looked for that thrasher for like 40 minutes. And I was looking at your score and I was like, oh, he bogeyed another hole. Yeah, I can look a few more minutes. There's nothing to get back to right now.
Yeah, you're willing to make yourself have excuses. And again, like think about it this way. You started playing golf, right?
Yes.
How many times have you gone to the range and like in your head say, you know what? I'm going to try this during this swing. And you try it and you hit a better shot. Do you now think all of a sudden you figured out your swing? Have you done that before?
I have. Yeah, I mean, I've never thought like I 100% figured it out, but I have like, I've literally texted you guys, been like, dude, no. I just figured this thing out that I think like this is part of what was messing me up. And then three swings later, you're like, it's gone. Oh, I had no idea where it went. Something,
you're like, you know what? I'm going to open my left foot a little bit. Or you know what? I'm going to take my club back. I'm going to like do this. Or
I'm going to take it more back behind me instead of up.
Yeah.
Try to get my swing shallow. Stuff. Yeah. Doesn't work.
And again, when you're at that beginning stages, you are literally willing to grab anything and hold on to anything that works.
Yeah.
And you're a psychopath because that is not the reason why you hit a good ball.
Yeah.
So that's just, I think that's where I was of where, you know, heck, I was throwing Glow Nuke SSs as my go-to distance driver, right? You can't be successful.
They
on
did
tour
go a long way. Okay, so caddies definitely make sense on the pro tour, but swing coach, I got to hear your thoughts on swing coaches.
Okay, swing coaches, I think, are 100% useful and will probably make a whole lot of money that are people that are, because one of the things that I think gives me a huge advantage over a lot of other people is I can quickly hear something from someone and adjust it and figure it out quickly. Mm-hmm. So like right now I'm fixing my forehand, right? Because my forehand got a little bit better and was decent, but now I'm at that plateau and it's like, okay, well, how do I get to the next level? And now to get to the next level, I have to do something differently.
Yeah.
So I've been watching, you know, other people's forehands. I was throwing today with Tristan Tanner, who has arguably one of the longest forehands on tour. And so now I'm trying to figure out how to gain power on my forehand, like, and what the next thing I can do. So I'm able to look at what other people are doing and then also have people say like, hey, if you do this, I think that will help you. And I'm able to like quickly kind of do it. And then now it's just reps to get it to be muscle memory. I think that style of teaching though, of where it's like, hey, this works for me, you do it, is probably not the best style of teaching. Because especially in disc golf, you look at, do I still have the world? I don't have the world rankings up, but I have this list. You look at Ricky, Paul, Calvin, Dickerson, Adam, Jones, Burr, Conrad, you throw those guys all in, right? Those are all top 20 guys. And you watch them all throw a backhand. There are, to the naked eye, there are some things that they all do. And they all do really, really well.
Yeah.
And then there's some things that they do completely different from one another. And I think to be a good teacher, you have to figure out those things that actually matter and the things that are, you know what, this works for Ricky because of this, and this works for Chris because of this, and this works for James because of this. And so I think down the road, swing coaches on the pro level, it's probably going to take a little bit longer to get there. But swing coaches for like amateurs, I think it's not going to be that long, especially because you're going to have a lot of these guys that are going to be retiring in 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
Looking for something to still do. And again, being really, really good at disc golf and being able to coach disc golf are two different things. But to say that it would not be helpful for someone to go to a good swing coach is wild.
So, but how does it get implemented on the pro tour? Because like PGA guys, PGA tour, from what I've seen, pretty much all of them have swing coaches. But like, how does that get started? Because
you gotta have like, I would pay good money for Drew Gibson to be my backhand swing coach.
Okay, but that's someone who like you would look at and say they have a better backhand than you. But like,
it's also someone that I've worked with, because when I was picking my swing coach for golf,
yeah,
I had two guys that were very, very good, mm-hmm. both coaching professional golfers,
yeah,
and both very reputable, knew what they were doing. I took a class from each one. Mm-hmm. Right before I picked, I took a class from each one, and I wanted to see their teaching style. I wanted to see just our relationship. And after those two classes, I said, you know what? Both of these could work, but this guy, I think I'm going to get better faster. Mm. So I've spent a lot of time with Drew and talked to him and worked with him a lot. So like, he's someone that, I know that if I go in a field with Drew, Ezra's another person, for example, like those are two guys that I know that if I go in a field with them, I can ask them questions. And because again, the relationship right now, they're not going to really come up to me and be like, hey man, I watched you in this video and you're doing this wrong. They're not doing that.
Yeah.
So a lot of it's like me saying like, hey, this is something that I think I'm struggling with. Can you watch and tell me what you think? Right. And then they can kind of help me fix it and we can work there. So the answer of why like I would pick him is not because he has a better backhand than me. It's because he knows the fundamentals to being able to throw a good backhand and does a good job of being able to, him and Ezra, same, being able to express that to me. Mm. That's why.
So do you think
that's why I would pick him?
You think it'd be someone who like starts as an amateur swing coach, becomes very reputable there, and then like one or two of their people that like they've been working with for years go pro, and then their name spreads on the pro tour that way. I'm just trying to think of like a scenario
that would help. That would definitely help build their name.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. I'm just trying to think of a scenario of Ricky, for instance, you know, or Paul or Eagle, like the top guys in the world, just randomly hiring a swing coach. Like that's such a drastic step in the sport that like, because I agree, when I picture the sport 10 years from now, that's a standard thing. It's like everyone's got someone they're working with, but like that initial leap is crazy. Like I don't know where, how that, like it has to be a gradual thing. I'm just trying to figure out like how that steps happen.
What if that person was a part of the team? So like Discraft
has a swing coach you could
hired
use.
Hired a swing coach available.
No, he hates it, Silas.
He hates it. What?
No, I don't like that.
He hates it. That's all you
Silas,
get.
Silas, do you know what?
Why do you hate
it? How our tennis team and golf teams worked in high school?
What do you mean?
How our practices worked for tennis and golf in high school?
Well, I assume, you know, you just play against each other and you learn from the one coach, right?
No.
Like I don't.
Our coaches for both tennis and for golf were basically people that were just there to, and this might be different, you know, this might be different for other high schools, but they were basically there just to sign up for, get us to the tournaments and be a chaperone and basically like that. Like,
so they weren't our like golf coaches.
We would go to our individual coaches that we've been with for like, I kind of gave up tennis and golf in like the middle part of my childhood. And then I got back to it later, But there's guys that were like on our tennis team that had their own coaches that have been coaching them for like 8 years. So like when we would go and practice, they went to their coach. Same in golf. Like you go and you practice, you go to your coach that you've been working with. Like think of like gymnastics too, right? Like gymnastics for like, let's say like the Olympics, right?
Yeah.
They all are bringing their own, like even though they're on Team USA and they're all working together, they're bringing their own individual coaches with them. There isn't a coach. It's not like basketball where she's oh my gosh, I can't say his name. Shishevsky?
Just go Coach K.
Coach K. It's not like basketball where like Coach K comes over and is the head coach for the team. Because you when you have like a team like that where like people are actually working together, then yes, you do need someone to like draw up the X's and O's and let people know what they're doing. But when you have a team that is quote unquote a team with individuals, right?
Yeah.
That's where people are going to have their own person. So like,
gotcha.
Discraft is never going to have a swing coach for the, or I wouldn't say never, but it would be crazy to me to think that you sign, if you're with Discraft, let's say, let's do this. Katrina Allen with Prodigy, right? And she has her own coach. And then all of a sudden she signs with DGA and now she has to not be able to have that coach. And now she has this other coach.
Hmm. Yeah. That's like a good
she's,
point.
You're going to tell me Katrina Allen's going to leave the person that she's won 2 world championships with for 7 years and all of a sudden go to this next person. So like, that's where I think it's very individualized too, because what works for Paul, what works for Chris, what works for Adam, all guys on Discraft might not work for me. Right. So having like one coach for everyone, I think you got to really find someone that suits you and works for you. But what I will say is could happen, and I just saw this in the chat, someone talking about Yuli. What I could see is like Yuli is a coach, right? And I sign him, Adam signs him, Kevin Jones signs him, Scott Withers signs him. So like when we all go to a tournament, Yuli goes there and he's working with each one of us, right? Like on his schedule, he's like, all right, Brody, I'm on the range with you from 10 to 11. Adam, I'll be with you from 1 to 2. So that way all 4 of us or 5 of us are paying for him and it kind of helps the cost. Same thing like with massage therapists, you know, only the top guys can afford to fly their massage therapist around to each event, right?
Yeah.
So what you end up doing if you're not one of the top guys is you end up finding 5, 6, 7 other dudes that are like, yeah, I would love to get massages after my rounds. Mm-hmm. So then we all say, okay, well, for this massage therapist to go on tour with us, we have to pay them $100,000. So we'll each just pay them $20,000. And now all of a sudden you have that massage therapist there for every event. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Boom.
That's a good point.
All right. I think time-wise, that's a pretty good segue to end it. We have a lot of questions that we didn't get to in the chat and a lot of voice questions that we'll have to bring back next week.
Have them call in.
If you have a question you feel like would be good, put it into the just head over to fdnsports.com, go to the debate night tab, and there's a plot space that you can leave a voice memo if you haven't already. We didn't get around to them tonight because my phone was acting up weird, but I've got a solid 5 or 6 starred, and then if you leave them, I'll listen to them before next week's episode and star some more, and next week we'll talk through what went down at Waco, and also we'll talk about what's coming up at, it should be the Open at Belton the week after. Also, the Bogey Bro Battle will be happening that week, so pretty exciting stuff going on in Texas. For these next
few
weeks.
I'm filming with Mason and Valerie on Thursday.
Heck yeah.
And that video will be up on, I think we're going to do like 9 holes on my channel, 9 holes on Foundation or something. So
awesome.
That'll be the team Foundation. Now that we're talking about teams, that'll be the team Foundation, getting together and playing a little bit on Thursday. So yeah. I am going to head to Greyhound now and pick up my buddy.
Perfect.
Who is going to be caddying for me and also running the Brody tractor.
Boom, boom. So I was going to ask about those. So That nails both those down. Hopefully you enjoyed this episode. If you want to check out some more content from us, we actually have a lot of planning going on behind the scenes. Trevor is getting pretty excited for this month's Patreon exclusive video. So if you join the Heiser Club, you can head to patreon.com/foundationdiscgolf, become a Heiser Club member, and get access to all kinds of extra stuff. We have the Heiser Club Q&A show, Heiser Club mailbag happening. We'll record that tomorrow, and then this month's video, I'm pretty sure Trevor said he's doing a little disc golf Jeopardy for Connor and I, and he's going pretty all out.
Heck yeah.
He's going all out. He found buzzers for us to buzz in. He's got the board getting all set up. He's very excited for this.
Yeah.
So I don't think you want to miss it. Like I said, you can go over to patreon.com/foundationdiscgolf and join the Heiser Club if you don't want to miss out on that and so much more. Super stoked. We're going to be really kicking that into gear in April. We're going to have a little more free time come April. Trevor and I will, and that's going to be one of our main focuses. So super stoked for that.
Oh, is that when the boss is coming in?
And that's when, yeah. Well, March 21st is the transition begins, and then April 1st, we kick it into high gear. It's showtime. So
yeah, me and Hunter are getting a boss. So
yeah, we're stoked.
We're gonna get whipped
into business shape, if you will. Super stoked for all of it. But thank you all so much for tuning in. And Brody, best of luck at Waco. Hope you shred.
Thank you. I'm going to Greyhound, and then I'm Planet Fitness, baby. Gonna get jacked.
There you go.